glasses. I got some reading books a lot. Certainly, I wasn't a, you know, my profanity when I made a bad pitch or something would kind of indicate that I was not exactly a practicing Christian. So I always thought that that would be the nickname. And then Pete Wisnan and Frank Robinson started calling me Fess, and Beta Pinson, well, Pinson would say it because Robinson. And they had explained it to me that that's what they had decided they were going to call me.
Short for professor.
Yeah. So I was Fess. In fact, I got a note. I think it says Fess, a letter from Cot Deal, who was the pitching coach in Cincinnati, 1 year. And Willard Schmidt, who was on the club at the time, who was from Oklahoma, he said they always referred to me as Fess. And that's where it started. With a month ago, guy, had workaholic, never been sick in his life, never been in the hospital in his life. He had pancreatic cancer.
Oh, that's a quick one.
Yeah, thought he was just having trouble with his stomach. And he let it go on too long, and they were dead. No chance. 8 days later, he's gone. So she's a little tough.
Did they start calling you professor after you wrote The Long Season?
Yes, and obviously, I think there's a reference in Penrose to professor. So it must have been right after that.
Or some...
It could have been the year even before, the year I was writing. It seems to me that's when Deal was there, in 60.
Yeah.
So,
were some ball players antagonistic toward your intellectuality? Or suspicious of it?
Yeah, Taylor Phillips said, you might have a lot of book learning, but you ain't got no fucking common sense. He was my roommate.
I've been told that.
We went out to some spaghetti place. He was going to give me a talking to. Old Taylor. He was from some little town in Georgia. He was a good little left-handed pitcher. Had country road smarts. I can't recall the name of the town he was from. But he was going to try and help me out. But I carried it too far, you know, being a carrying my record player along with me so I could listen to Brahms and Mozart and Bartok and then do it, which he disliked.
Not just an act.
A great deal. You know? He couldn't stand that music, and I didn't have earphones on. If I wanted to play it, I either had to wait till he left the room or he had to put up with it. Why couldn't I get some good old C&W? You know? Well. I dislike that as much as he disliked Bartok.
I talked to Jim Bouton a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about...
You told me.
Yeah. And we talked about how some athletes are suspicious of people with too much education or brains. I think he sensed that at some points.
Suspicious, he put it that way?
No,
suspicious.
I don't know if that's the word he used, but...
You said antagonistic, and I don't ever recall any of that. The Milwaukee Braves, Burdett and Edcock and Matthews, they used to get on my ass a lot of bench jockeying and stuff. But I would... Fortunate, but I don't have good hearing in my left ear. So
very convenient.
In Milwaukee, the dugouts, you know, the visiting dugout here and the home dugout there were both on the first base side, and I really couldn't hear much of what they said.
Did you get any heat over writing those books?
Almost exclusively from the establishment.
From above.
The Cardinal management, especially. Harry Carey told me once that Augie Bush was just livid and wanted me out of there. So I wasn't pitching too well. I wasn't getting along with him, so it was a good bet that I was going to be gone anyway.
Early in '60,
right?
Late '59, yeah.
And Bing Devine, of course, he was general manager. It was his job to find somebody, you know, that he could trade for, and he finally caught on with Cincinnati. Well, he knew that Hutch was going to go over there to Cincinnati. How he knew that, I don't know, because Mayo Smith was the manager, and they made the deal with, still a month and a half before the All-Star game, the All-Star break. But apparently, Devine and Hutch talked, and Devine asked him if he would want me over there at Cincinnati. He had me there before at St. Louis, and he said yes very much. So they made the deal. Jeff goes for me. And I've talked to Brian. He's got a radio program in St. Louis. Or has had one in the past. I've been on a couple of times. And he said that was the worst deal he ever made in his life. That's what he introduced. Most times he introduced the program. And here's a guy who was in the worst deal I ever made as general manager. And it was my fault. He never really did blame
the people who told him.
Bush or the other people. Fred Fleischman, I guess he was upset too. He thought he was a good friend. Fred Fleischman was the account representative for Budweiser.
Were they upset that you were taking time from your pitching time to do this, or the fact that it was a book that was going to tell things that happened in the clubhouse?
Right. It was inside. It was an inside story, and inside stories had not been told.
Yeah, you were the pioneer, certainly.
I had never been warned that I couldn't do it, but and of course there had been a couple of magazine stories in Sports Illustrated when I was with St. Louis, and they weren't exactly, but the same format, the journal format. I got no heat from that at all. Of course, they didn't really knock the organization, neither the Cubs nor the Cardinals. The first story was about being traded. The only significant thing that happened to me in my career, I got traded from one club to another. And the people at Sports Illustrated were just starting the magazine. They had asked me, Bob Boyle specifically, he had asked me, I mean, he's an assistant editor or something, associate editor, I don't know what they call it. And he had asked me if anything happened that I thought I would like to put down on paper to do it, and if they would like to look at it. And the first piece went off very well. And the second piece was about Hutch and my relationship with Hutch. Calling him a surrogate father. And
he was something, wasn't he?
And rather uplifting rather than denigrating the organization. So they didn't mind that at all. But here was a book, the opening chapters, of course, are about, I made fun of Sally Hemus and his coaches.
Start off talking about salary negotiating.
That.
Which is a touchy subject.
Certainly. That was considered, you know, what you say here, you do not divulge. Nobody knew salaries of ball players. They very carefully kept that information from the players so they couldn't make arguments on comparative, but talent, that sort of thing. And of course, you didn't have an agent. You couldn't have a... Joey Jay, when he was with Cincinnati after we won the pennant, he brought in a lawyer to his negotiation, if you call it that, with Bill DeWitt. And DeWitt said, I'll talk to you, Jay, or I'll talk to him, but I won't talk to the both of you at the same time. So what good was the lawyer? Well, they settled on a contract, pretty good, and the lawyer sent him a bill for $5,000. I think the contract might have been 35, at the tops 35, maybe around 30, 35. And the guy sends him a bill for $5,000, and Jay, you know, I'm going to have to hire.
Everyone is raised.
I'm going to have to hire another lawyer to negotiate this bill down, which he eventually did. I think he paid $1,500. Because the guy didn't get him any of that. I mean, the difference between what DeWitt had offered and what they eventually settled at was about $2,500. So, but that was the thing that they did not want in the particular book. Gabe Paul, who had been a friend, I'd known him before when he was at Cincinnati, before I even got into pro ball. He and my father were friends. He had one objection. He said, in the book, you describe a scene where you're coming through the dugout and Ernie Broglio, who's going to pitch that night against you, is there, and you
fraternize.
We not only fraternize, but I said, Ernie, you give me one high fastball, I give you one high fastball. One pitch, that's all. One pitch. And he said, okay. Okay, Bros. And, of course, Rolio comes up with men on second and third. He gets nothing but curveballs and just strikes out, and I'm up in the next inning. That's all I get to. So that was the point of the story. But I mean, that's the reason I put it in there. But Paul said even the suggestion that there would be collusion on a pitch is against the rules. A venial sin compared to what what the owners did in their collusion and a lot of others.
That's one of the things I've noticed on this trip I've taken is the extent of fraternization now between the teams. I was in Pittsburgh and saw Zane Smith get knocked out in the first inning one night, and I was on the Braves bench the next day before the game, and there was Zane Smith sitting on the Braves bench chatting with his old buddies from from Atlanta.
Right. I don't think they could control them among the Latin players. They gave up. For a couple of years, an umpire was assigned, you know, to watch from the stands to see if anybody, if there was any talk between opposing uniform. And that guy was then hauled in and said, you can't do this. But the Latin players just paid absolutely no attention to it at all. And, you know, I didn't hear that. What'd you say?
What?
Que pasa? And they gave up. They gave up on it. Yeah. Very quickly. I mean, it didn't last very long.
Yeah. I think it's a sign also of how the union has brought players closer together as a unit, that loyalties are more interchangeable now than they were.
And the fact that players move from one club to another so easily. I mean, almost, if you want to, all you have to do is last 6 years in the big leagues. And you can go anywhere you want. And you don't have to stay there very long.
Does the decade or so when you play now seem like the dark ages in retrospect as far as what players...
I didn't think much of it myself at the time. Mostly because I was just happy to be in the big leagues in the first place. I had only one, the holdout with the Cardinals really wasn't much. I was negotiating. Devine had said, I actually enjoyed it. In most cases, a guy would come in there, he wouldn't know what to say, and all I had to do was tell him, well, this is what you're going to get, and he would sign it. That would be it. There would be no negotiation. What was the point of my job? My function was destroyed, he said. So I had a talk with Gabe Paul. He wanted to sign me for 2 years. And I talked to my boss, who was in advertising business here in Chicago. I worked for him for a number of years. And he said, well, what if you have a good year and you're locked into a contract which you could kick up maybe 10% or 20% or more if you have a great year? Well, I didn't expect to have a great year, but it'd be a good year was possible. And so I said, no, I'm only signing for 1 year. He said, well, I can't give you the kind of money for 1 year that I can give you for 2 years. That really was extended. He actually did. He gave me that money,
yeah.
Which a little surprising. as to feeling that I didn't like the contract, being bound to one club, yeah. and the fact that I couldn't move somewhere. I didn't like it, but I mean, that's the way it is. I disliked very much the line in the contract that said, anything that I would write and attempt to publish could be, had to be reviewed, had to be, mandatory, had to be reviewed,
really?
And could be censored.
Yeah,
that was in that, and well, why it was there, I don't know, because I had...
Just in your contract?
Because no, this is the uniform Major League contract. It's still there, still in there. The union can't get it out, because there's other things. There are a lot of other things. The ball club would like control to the extent. Anything that the player could do or say.
Controlled your public appearances and all of that promotional work.
They wanted it positive. That is, they didn't want any negative publicity coming out of a player. Well, I disliked it because that was going to be my job. It was an avocation, but I hoped to do it when I got through playing ball, if it was possible. And here I was selling. I had sold a couple of pieces the year that my last year. I had sold a piece to Atlantic Monthly and another to a Sport Magazine in January. And I hadn't seen a contract yet, of course. And here comes a contract with an additional note saying that you will not be allowed to publish anything at all during the season. You cannot publish during the season.
That was so you would keep your mind on your work?
Perhaps. This was Ed Short, who was the general manager of the White Sox.
White Sox.
Yeah, punk who thought he was he had some power, he was going to wield some power. And we got to the, Brett Musburger was working for the Chicago Daily News at the time. And he and I got along well. And so we negotiated in the paper this contract, which I had a feeling that I wasn't going to last much longer. I couldn't get strikes with a low slider in the American League, which was my out pitch. And I didn't have any other pitches, and I didn't think I was going to be able to develop one real quick. And I had tried they call it a split finger fastball. I had tried that. I'd thrown a few spitballs. Never had any success with a splitter at all. The knuckleball was the next possible thing, and that's an entirely different kind of motion. It takes years really to develop the knuckleball. So I probably had about had it at 33. It wasn't likely I was going to last a year or two. And Musburger's going along with this because he thinks he's got a story. He can argue this, and he can make fun of the White Sox, which he did. A couple good columns on it. I still have one of them. Well, I got released. And they sent me the notice that I was being released, or had been put on waivers, and could be picked up for a dollar. Nobody had claimed me. Well, the letter came without a stamp on it. I had to pay whatever it was, 16 cents at the time. I had to pay. I knew what it was. The mailman standing there, been around here quite a while.
Do I want to share this from the White Sox? This or not?
You think this is worth it, he said. Then he stood there while I opened it. Well, I'm a young guy. We talked a lot about baseball. Okay. So I had to pay for my
own death notice.
notification on that no longer was in the big league.
When I look through these books, and, inevitably they're compared to Boughton's book, and as they cover the same kind of territory, and the main similarity to me is that they explore the roller coaster emotions of being a pitcher, particularly a relief pitcher, and that's what interests me most about them. But still, there are mentions in these books of pain pills, uppers, alcohol abuse, and other things that Boughton caught heat for 10 years later for writing about. Were those subjects just not considered as seriously then, or I know you didn't make a big deal about them.
Bullies certainly had been around in baseball for a hell of a long time. I mean, it was a staple, like bread and meat and bullies. Cardinals had Paul Wehner, still teaching batting.
I know,
only in the morning.
Some of the stories I've read about him are amazing.
Yeah, but it was an accepted practice. You could drink. Pot was around. This is early. Well, this is very early '60s. Cocaine, I doubt it. Although there was plenty of cocaine in jazz clubs. I don't know, '20s. I suspect that there might have been a ball player or two who tried a little blow once in a while. But of course those drugs were deleterious and everybody knew it. As for the greenies, the dexamils, or dexedrines, or dexamil, I think dexamil, that gave them a two-hour euphoric lift. Might be a little shot of adrenaline, perhaps.
Yeah. They were pretty commonly used, though.
Commonly used. They were in the medicine chest, let's put it that way. But I would say 25 or 30% of the players used them. Not on the clubs I played.
Pain pills were more common, right?
Aspirin. What do you mean by pain pills?
Guys with sore arms had to go out and pitch with sore arms. Mo Drabowski told me a story about when he was 90 days away from qualifying for the pension, and he had a rotten arm. I think he was with the Reds, he said. And he had his do or die game. He could hardly lift his arm, and he got a cortisone shot and got some pain pills. And he said he took them for the 90 days that he had to keep going to qualify for the pension. And the day he qualified, he flushed the rest of them down the toilet. But
I've heard him tell that story. Then his arm came back.
Then his arm came back, right. Yeah, then he had his real good years later on.
Oh, yeah. The cortisone shots were not not rare. Well, yeah, they were rare. I had three in three different years. I had inflammation of the lower head and biceps, which is from throwing a slider.
Uh-huh.
And one each season. And then it would come back.
They make a big difference, the cortisone shots?
They relieve the pain for a while. But just briefly, actually. A couple hours. And of course you weren't supposed to pitch after you took the shot. You weren't supposed to throw for a day or two.
You're supposed to wait till it hurt again.
That's right. Well, it would hurt. It'll hurt again. You know, if there's inflammation there, it'll hurt. Sometimes if a guy hit put the needle right into the core of the inflammation, it would get rid of it soon. Rest would get rid of it also. But you couldn't rest. I mean, they didn't. I don't even know whether we had a disabled list back then.
You were expected just to tough it out. And
oh,
keep
sure.
Going out there.
Oh, hell
it's
yeah.
A much different attitude.
Especially if you were a player like me, competent at my job, but not somebody that they would baby at all. They could always find somebody else who was competent at the job too. So you got it out. That's what you'd have to. You didn't. There weren't that many jobs in the big leagues. I mean, 16 clubs. If you got there, you did whatever you had to do to stay there.
much different now with sore arms.
Yeah, I do have an infected cuticle. Your agent advises you to go on a 15-day. Well, in the sight of Eric Davis and Daryl Strawberry sitting on the bench making $8 million for reasons that nobody, I mean, the guy's got a bad back, all right. I've had bad backs myself, and so I sympathize with him, or I could empathize with him if I knew what his bad back was all about. But it's not, they are not role models for for the players that I'd like to see them.
Do you think there are more sore arms now, or does it only seem that way because more attention is paid to them?
I doubt it. There are more sore arms. There probably were more sore arms back then. But so what? You had a sore arm, you pitched anyway. If you were capable of throwing, you threw. If you had some pains, well, so what? I mean, pain you live with. Warren Spahn couldn't comb his hair for 3 years, but he took his, I mean, he was out there every fourth day, throwing. Fortunately, all his hair left his head, and he didn't have to comb. But he, you know, Burdette, same way. Burdette said he'd take that shot whenever it was necessary, and it was often necessary. Because he not only threw the slider, but he threw the screwball also.
Yeah.
That wasn't going like this. So he said he lived with pain for maybe the last 5 or 6 years of his career.
Why
he knew he was going to get it. He forgot about it.
Why is the slider so tough on the arm? I know it's sort of gotten out of use the last 10 years or so. Fewer guys.
A lot more guys are getting sore arms. And so pitching coaches were going back to trying to teach the curveball. It's a hell of a lot more difficult to throw than the slider. And just as dangerous. I mean, you hurt your arm as much with the curveball as you do with the slider. But the slider's easy to teach, and it's much easier to control. You don't need much of a break. You can get a lot of the strike zone you can throw the slider in. All you got to do is make the ball move 4 inches or 5 inches. And it requires a last-minute twist of the ball. You have to put spin on the ball at the last, just before the delivery. And so it's that twist, that rotation that you use, and there's muscle in the forearm and that lower head of the bicep and your shoulder, both come into play. And you keep it, you throw enough of them, you're almost certain to get some sort of inflammation. If you, a relief pitcher who's going to do it day after day after day, gets no chance to be worked down. And actually, we weren't using ice much. I never had any ice on my shoulder at all.
Now they ice everything.
young ones that they were, Maloney, Jim Maloney. I remember him using ice, and Jay Hook used ice. They were pitchers who were young enough that they were, they're going to treat them with the newest. And the veterans, of course, would say, ah, I don't need that shit. I pitch for this long, I go along with what I usually do and have a beer.
Maloney had arm troubles all through his career anyway.
He often did, yeah. Well, he had got a tremendous torsion on his breaking ball. And then he even his fastball. The guy threw so hard.
And he pitched a ton of innings.
And he pitched an awful lot.
He was my favorite when I was growing up.
Really?
I was a Reds fan. My father's from Cincinnati.
Oh.
So I grew up as a, still am a big Reds fan. You threw the slider, what, two-thirds, three-quarters of the time?
No. Oh, not more than half.
Yeah.
55, 60% maybe. Because I had, I could control the fastball. I didn't have great stuff. I'd maybe 82, 85. I'd get up to 85. But I threw the slider at almost the same speed, so it was useful for me to use both pitches. Have a guy looking for the breaking ball, that little break in the ball, and the fastball sneaked right on by. So I was sneaky fast. And then I had a good changeup. And I used a change a lot. The slider, that was my strike pitch and my strikeout pitch. The pitch I would use when I was behind a hitter, guy looking for a fastball, he'd get a slider. He might get a change, but he's not going to get a fastball. Difference between a finesse pitcher and a power pitcher. A power pitcher would throw the fastball. Robin Roberts would say, throw it. Throw your fastball, throw it high.
Yeah, right.
Exactly the thing you shouldn't, you're taught not to do.
If you're Robin Roberts.
If you're Robin Roberts, you get away with it. You might throw 35 home runs a year, but he usually got, he said, one out of 10, one out of 20, one out of 100. A guy hit the ball out of the ballpark. If he happens to hit it real good, you got a little movement on the ball, throw it 90 miles an hour, you'll get away with it most of the time. And of course he did.
That's about right. He threw 100 pitches a game, he'd give up a home run. That's about what he did on average. What was the difference in Cincinnati? Was having Bill Henry as a counterpart in the bullpen, was that a big factor in your success there?
I think it made both of us more effective. And if either one of us had been the closer.
You were one of the first tandems, right-left tandems, I think.
That's probably true. I can't think off of him. And of course, we were entirely different. He was a power pitcher, and I was a finesse pitcher. He could get right-handers out, and I could get left-handers out, which made it, he would get the right-handers out with he had great control of his fastball. I think he was fast. He could throw hard. And he'd hit the outside corner of right-hand hitters all day long. And even if they hit it, they weren't going to hit it anywhere. They didn't hit it very often. And I'd throw that slider up and in. We had a pitching coach, Jim Turner, the old colonel. Yeah. And Turner hated the slider.
He
wanted the big overhand curve. He wanted me to develop a big overhand curve. Well, I had it. I threw a slow overhand curve, not very often. And he said, you can't get away with that slider. I mean, that was my out pitch, and then I had to wonder about Jim Turner's advice. I mean, he's looking at me for 4 years, and I'm still doing it. And he's saying, you can't do that. You can't get a guy out with that pitch. Can't pitch in a big league with that little curveball. So,
Bouton called him one of the great second guessers of all time.
Yeah, his people who didn't like him found reasons to dislike him. I didn't mind that. Well, I enjoyed talking to him, as long as we didn't talk about pitching, because he was telling me things that weren't true about me. I just decided that if he had a kid like Maloney that he could develop, that his style, what he taught, would be very valuable to Maloney. useless to me because I just didn't have the kind of stuff that would be necessary to use it, what he was teaching. As it turned out, Maloney went on to really pitch like the colonel told him to pitch. Big overhand curve and lots of power. And, I could have done that if I wanted to, you know, to follow the colonel's teachings. But he was a gentleman, and he was a very lovable man. Hutch was likable, the colonel was lovable. But you had to want to have an affection for him, and if you wanted to, if you didn't like him, well, there's a lot of reasons why you could dislike him.
What was the key to Hutchinson's success as a manager?
He could imbue the player with his competitiveness and his desire to win,
which was fierce.
Which was beyond fierce. It was a true passion. He was obsessed with winning. And just in baseball, he wasn't like that about anything else that I ever found out about. You know? But being like that and being able to convince ball players that they should follow that path, that they should at least feel some of that, is the difference between a manager and a guy who wears number one. There are a lot of people who have what they think is an obsession with winning, but they can't convince anybody else to share that or to try and emulate it. And he could do that. He did it with me. And on that particular ball club, I think he did it with a number of people. Gene Fries, Gordon Coleman.
Of course, Frank Robinson
had it,
right? Yeah.
And probably Pinson was imitating more Robinson's, but like Jerry Lynch, who never had shown, I don't know that he had ever shown it before because I didn't know him before. Those were all key guys on the club, and a couple of pitchers who hadn't had the kind of careers that we all had together. If we hadn't all played over our heads.
Like Jay and Perky.
I think Perky always had it. Jay could take it or leave it. But for a couple of years under Hutch, he didn't dare leave it. Because you didn't, you didn't want to face the man if you didn't do what he thought was your best. And he would tell you. He came out to the mound once, and he grabbed the ball from me and said, "That's the worst fucking pitching I ever saw in my life."
He was probably right, too.
And he was right. Oh, he was absolutely right. I mean, I walked a couple of guys and hung a curveball. Just terrible pitching. I mean, it was just awful. He wouldn't say it if it wasn't true. So he wouldn't... He would encourage you with criticism. Some managers can do it. Get on a player, really rip him in an attempt to wake him up or kick him in the butt or whatever they call it. I've never found that. That's that sort of inspiration, if you call it that, it would never work with somebody with my personality.
Sort of DeRocher's approach.
Well, in this town, it'd be more like Mike Ditka's approach.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Doug Collins was like that with the Bulls. And the reason the Bulls become suddenly so much better after Doug Collins left is because the guy they got was a psychologist. I mean, he knew how to handle people. Doug Collins did. He knew how to yell at people.
Yeah, Jackson's good.
Very good. Very good. Hutch would only yell at people when they deserve to be yelled at. So you respected him for that. And you had to respect his desire, his competitiveness. And one way or another, the stories about him, about what kind of stuff he had and how he lasted, how he pitched the big leagues, they got spread around. Otero, Dick Sisler, even the Colonel. The Colonel would tell stories about Hutch when he was in Detroit. guy with not very good, not really, barely competent big league fastball, and a good curveball. And they would wonder how he got people out, but he was a big winner.
Yeah.
He had pretty good ball clubs, but even so, they would love to have him pitch, and then they would wonder how in the hell he beat him. That was the kind of pitcher he was. It became obvious that he did it strictly through his own guts, his own, he overwhelmed people with his desire to win. He wanted it better than, more than the batters wanted, the other team wanted, and so he would come out on top.
And his teammates would play better for him.
Sure.
Undoubtedly.
Oh, yeah. If they didn't, he'd chew their ass up. Because he was tough. He was a very strong man. Yeah, perfectly willing to beat up anybody who didn't play as well as he. And I'm sure he would want to do that as a manager, too, but he knew well enough. He learned in the minor leagues how to keep that part of himself under control. I just did a little 1,500-word kind of essay, memoir, Hutchinson.
Oh, yeah.
Bill James got a new book.
It's a baseball book?
It's a baseball book with there's all the stats in, everybody who ever played in big leagues.
Oh, cool.
But he has little vignettes about certain players, most of the Hall of Famers, I guess, and certain other people that he wanted. And they're going to have all that. It's supposed to be 500 words, each one of these little remembrances. I gave him 1,500, he said, you cut this down. Well, he was right, I did cut it down. He's a memorable guy. I mean, if you played for him, you never forgot him.
You play for anybody, any other managers who stood out?
Only one, Don Osborne.
Don Osborne.
Yeah, he was in the big leagues. He was a pitching coach at, I think it's Philly, but I know he was at Pittsburgh for a number of years.
He managed you in the minors?
Yeah. He managed me at, at Macon, Georgia, my third year, and he was at Nashville the next year when I was on my way from AAA ball to B-ball. on my way right out of the game.
I was going to say, did you despair at times? I know you spent, 7 years in the minors?
Well,
did you despair that you were going to make it?
Well, sure. When I came out of the Army, I had a guaranteed job. You had to get your job back under the GI Bill. But I went 4-17 at AAA. And I deserved it. I deserved the record. I was incompetent. And so I was enrolled in a hurry up. It was well known in Washington, D.C., the place where if you wanted your CPA in 3 years and a government job, this is where you went. It was called Benjamin Franklin University. It was a university in Pittsburgh. Named graduates, celebrity graduates, in that business. By the way, the class was 24 for the first month. And when I left, there were only 8 people left. I mean, that's how fast you realize you couldn't go through the law and the math as fast as they were teaching it. But they guaranteed you a job. Nobody who ever graduated from it ever failed his exam or failed to get a 10 or a 12 right out of, right out of school. And G-10s were paying pretty good money. Hell of a lot more than I was making at the baseball player. But the Cubs were so starved for any talent at all that they called and said, well, we're going to take you to spring training and we're going to give you $5,000 to if you make the ball club. Well, I'll be damned, I made the ball club. I didn't deserve to be there, but I made the ball club. I always had a good sprint, though, to get off to a good start. But by the time they were ready to send me out, Bob Sheffing, who was coaching at the time, he said to somebody in the dugout, he told me the story later, or maybe Mary Sheffing told my wife. But he told somebody, he said to somebody, every time Brosnan sticks his head out of the bullpen, somebody hits a line drive. So they sent me down to Des Moines, and I was there for 3 weeks, I think. And Ted Kwasniewski hit a line drive, broke Bubba Church's jaw. And I had been the first one out, and they called me back. Well, I still couldn't pitch in the big leagues, but I was now getting some pretty good coaching from Howie Paulette. And when they did send me down, he had convinced me that I had to have that break. I had to have the slider to go with the fastball and the change. I had the fastball and the change, but I didn't have a breaking ball. I didn't have any breaking ball at all. And he had shown me how to do it, how to throw it. And he said, you try this. You're not going to... He was a big overhand curveball man himself, but after working and finding out, I just never did master the release point on a curveball. You have to have your arm set in such a way that you can get maximum spin, maximum rotation from your hand. But you also have to release it at the right place. Well, I couldn't get, I might throw the same pretty good overhand curveball, but you can't throw it in the same place twice. You have to throw it up, maybe here for a strike, and then you got to throw it down. Well, I throw the same one over and over again. Well, the third one, they'd hit out of the ball.
They're ready for you.
Oh, sure, they could read it. You had to vary the release point and vary either the speed or the spin on the curveball. So he said, try the slider. And when I get to Beaumont, Texas, there's Max Lanier. And Max had learned the slider just like Sal Magley had in the Mexican League, where they used to dazzle. They'd pitch every third day, and they dazzled those guys with a little slider. And so he worked with me also. And I went 8-1. First time I Houston, the owner of several little minor league clubs. And he had the Beaumont Club. He bought the Beaumont Club with two other investors for $3,000 or $4,000. I mean, Beaumont's a terrible place. They had a terrible ballpark. People didn't particularly care for baseball. And it was hotter than hell. It was the hottest place I've ever been in my life. He had 17 players. That's all he could afford. And the kind of guys he got were misfits from organizations. I think he deliberately went out and asked, "You have any guy on your ball in your organization that that doesn't seem to fit in, doesn't seem to conform? I think we'll take him. He'll get to play in the Double A ball of Texas League." And so we had a bunch of them. The Yankees had a couple of players there. The kid Knobloch at Minnesota.
Yeah.
His uncle, yeah. Eddie Knobloch. I think he led the league in hitting or was very close to leading the league.
Did many of them get to the majors from there? Probably not.
Dave Hillman was up here briefly with the Cubs. Darius Hillman. And I think he was with the Mets
pitcher.
For a brief time. Pitcher, yeah.
Pitcher.
Yeah. Left. Right-handed pitcher. Right. Yeah. And I think that was it. I don't think there was anybody else on that ball club. We had the center fielder who, Christ, I can picture him, but he hit well for us, and he could go get the ball. But he was from the Yankee organization. And then in the Kurt Flood trial, his name came up as somebody, one of our lawyers, brought it up, as the kind of guy who never got a chance the Yankees didn't want him on their club. He probably could make the club anyway, but he never got a chance because they wanted to stop. This is the kind of guy they stocked their AA and AAA teams, especially the AAA team,
uh-huh,
in Newark and Kansas City, wherever they had
him. Like Ricky had bombed the Cardinals.
Right. Well, it was a custom. For it still is. Still is. All minor league heads of the minor league system, yeah, of ball clubs. Yeah. They have their scouts and their minor league managers evaluate their players as big league prospects, AAA, AA, because they want to stock the teaching clubs with veterans who really know how to play the game. And of course they make the judgment. This guy can't make it. And that guy won't get a shot at it.
Right.
Unless he goes to another organization, that's the only way to get a chance. Well, this happened to this guy whose name I can't recall. Got drunk with him one night. Well.
You played with Flood in St. Louis,
mm-hmm,
briefly, right?
Right.
Were you friends with him?
No. I mean, not that I was unfriendly.
Yeah.
I wasn't unfriendly with him. He wasn't unfriendly with me. It was just that he was black and I was white.
How did you come to be asked to testify?
The best I could recall, I used to have the transcript. I kept it for years along with notes, a letter that I got from Red Smith. I had lunch with Red Smith and Flood that day of the trial. And some other stuff. And I thought, well, one of these days I'm going to be able to use this. I looked again today. I thought,
really?
I'd dig it out of my file somewhere. I must have thrown it out for something or other. So along with that, a lot of other stuff, and I could throw away because I figured that if you tried it three or four times, that's about as long as you can keep it. Well, as best as I can recall, Jim Bunning was supposed to. They had asked him. I believe the young lawyer that called me. Said that Bunny was going to appear for him, and then all of a sudden, suddenly he backed down. No, Bunny was the player rep, National League player representative.
Right.
Very knowledgeable, and a tough guy. I mean, he would have made a terrific witness for Flood, but he was still active.
No. Not by the time of the trial. He was done after.
He was minor league manager.
Yes.
Right.
That's
the
what
Phillies organization.
Right.
I didn't get it from anybody, but I got to assume that he was told, you cannot do it. Because nobody else.
Nobody else active.
For Flood, who was active.
Right.
Or even thought about being a, getting back into the game. I never, of course, didn't. I don't even know whether I was number two. All I know is that they were looking for somebody who was at least active recently in order to hang. And to explain a player's viewpoint.
Because you were articulate, I see.
That I'm sure that worked into it also. So they flew me in and I went to the court and bowed to Shapiro and they raked me over. I'm a lawyer. The National League must have had five lawyers. All wanted to ask their questions. And one was threw little puffballs and then they threw a little harder and pretty soon it got to be a hard ball.
What were they breaking
Arthur,
down?
Art Goldberg, he really ripped into one of them. Heyman, I think he's still around. He worked for Boy Kuhn.
Hoynes?
Hoynes.
Lou Hoynes.
Lou Hoynes, that was it. He, asked me if I got paid my expenses. And Goldberg interrupted me and said, that was one of the cheapest shots I've ever heard, Mr. Hoynes. Of course he got paid his expenses. Just as you got paid your expenses. And your witnesses were paid.
Well, that fooled. I had, up to that time, been a somewhat of a wise ass. Then there was laughs. There was some laughter, except for Bowie Kuhn. Kuhn was right in line with me. And, he didn't like me. He didn't like me appearing for the flood.
Well, what were you talking about? The hypocrisies in baseball, or just general conditions of employment, or
the. We went through all my contracts every year.
Terms of contracts.
Right.
I see.
And the only reason I had got to the point where I was, the money I was making, I had a, well, the relationship with Gabe Paul was pretty good. And I got a good raise the year after I, because I hadn't taken a 2-year contract. I jumped 2,000 and 2,000. Nowadays it'd be 200,000 and 200,000 or more.
At least 200,000.
But when I was with the Cubs, I had signed an $8,500 contract, but was boosted. I was being paid at 15,000 because P.K. Wrigley had decided on his own that his starting pitchers were worth $15,000 a year. That's what they that's what they should be paid, whether they could pitch like that.
This guy,
well,
this
I opened,
starting.
I was the opening day pitcher. Another one of those circumstantial things. Bob Rush had a sore arm, and Dick Drott and Mo Drabowski were serving their army time, their reserve time, and I would have been the fourth starter, but in this case, I jumped all the way up to the opening day pitcher. And I was doing all right. I think I was 4-5 or 5-4 or something like that. But when I went to St. Louis, I wasn't carrying an $8,500 contract. I was carrying a $15,000 contract. It surprised the hell out of me. So I had gotten that boost and made the point. Ordinarily, I would have been an $8,500 pitcher despite the fact I'd been in the big leagues for 3 years. I wasn't making much more than I had when I was in the minor leagues. And in most cases, you went up incrementally. If you've got a $1,500 raise, you know, you could have $320 and get a $1,500 raise because everybody, that's what you got. That's all that the big league clubs would raise you.